Please listen carefully.
And now, live from an airport commandeered by cosplayers, it's the Assuming Positions Podcast, featuring two cartoon characters with overly animated mouths, Kevin and Mikey.
Hey everybody, Assuming Positions Podcast 2019 Anime Dallas. Kevin over here.
And Mikey over here.
And we have a terrific guest on our podcast. Very exciting. Jason Douglas is here with us. Hey, Jason.
What's up, guys? Good to be with you.
Oh, extremely excited to have you here. This is a pleasure. Thank you.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Jason Douglas is a voice actor. You might know him as Barris from Dragon Ball Super, Masaoka. But what really excited me, one of his first things he said he ever did... Bogum Crisis 2040.
That's right.
Detective Leon.
That's right. I understand, man. You just did an episode on the original Bubblegum Crisis.
We did. We did an episode talking about the original Bubblegum Crisis, a reassumption of it.
Right.
And we loved it again after we watched the subtitle version of it.
Subtitles were of dubious distinction at that time.
Yeah. And that's something we're so glad you're here to talk to us, because that is one thing that came up. We saw you in the old versus new panel, which was a great panel. We had a whole bunch of veteran voice actors, and then we also had a whole bunch of brand new voice actors. And you guys were having tons of fun up there. It might help that it was late and the bar was serving.
But there was one of the attendees
here asked you a wonderful question.
Right.
Because there is a debate in the anime world where some people prefer the subtitled stuff over the dub stuff.
Is this still a debate? Is that still happening? 20 years later, are we still debating subs versus dubs?
The thing is that it came up on our podcast because the original Bubblegum Crisis came over here in the early 90s before any of you guys were doing your business.
Yeah. Right.
And it was not good.
Right.
So
I'm glad you said that was before we all started, because that's a very important distinction. We are not responsible for crappy 80s dubs of shows
early
90s.
Yeah. So you had mentioned that, like, Bill from accounting.
Yeah, right.
The
thing is that, like, you know, the early dubs, and I mean, really, like, the reason I think that Japanese animation in general, or anime in general, particularly, the dubs of those shows kind of had a very, I would say, you know, negative reputation, is just that those were kind of, the dubs were considered almost kind of a throwaway thing. It certainly never has been, and certainly wasn't then, like a union job or anything, any, like a lucrative job at all.
Gotcha.
And obviously there wasn't the kind of market for anime that we have now. And it's easy to kind of look around us, you know, here at a show like this and see the... I don't know if you can hear that in the background, the cheering crowd.
They can, and that's what we love. Yeah.
There was nothing like that in 1992. No one cared about anime except a few just kind of hardcore fanboys, really. Yeah. You know, it was those guys. It was the kind of people that would, like, send off to Japan for a laser disc with like maybe three episodes of a show, and they would pay $100 for it. That's how anime came over from Japan. And so the idea of spending a lot of money on a dub, just that didn't cross anybody's mind. And so that's why a lot of the dubs that did exist almost feel like fan dubs or like experimental, and the idea of the other thing you were fighting against back then as well is you didn't have digital recording. So everything was recorded to tape and
back on the analog process.
Yeah. And so you can imagine, like, not only trying to match lip flaps, but what you're recording is going to tape, and that's hard. That's there. Like, once it's on tape, it's there. You can record over it, but you've got diminishing quality as you continue to record tape. You know, so you've got to kind of rewind the tape and make another pass. A couple of things. Maybe the most important thing that I think affected the increase in dub quality is digital recording. When you could go into a software program and, like, you know, make a pass at a line and then immediately make another pass, and then within the program, start moving that, you know, that file around until it sort of matched up. And, like, then you had, like, real-time editing in the process. It was almost like you were putting the actor on the stage or in the scene with the other characters, and you could get, like, a much more fully realized performance. So digital recording for sure was like a huge revolution for anime because it enabled us to do these things a lot more quickly. And then I think the next thing that was a major kind of milestone in some ways was when you had basically, I credit ADV Films just because they had such a huge volume in the late 90s and early aughts. And one of the things that they did was they took it away from Phil in accounting. And they said, you know what? We have a vibrant theater scene here in Houston. We like to go to theater. We see a lot of really good actors on stage. Why don't we bring those guys in to do some of these roles? And so...
Is that how you got your start? Were you one of those?
I got my start.
You're referring to yourself in this situation. I like it.
Well, yeah, but you know what? I'm referring to Lucy Christian and Chris Patton and Jessica Calvello and virtually, I mean, Monica Rial, virtually everybody that has been doing this for a while, particularly those of us who got our start in Houston, were theater actors. We were stage actors in Houston, and someone... you know, came along and said, hey, there's this gig. You don't have to wait tables anymore. there's this company in Houston, Texas that's recording these Japanese cartoons. And we were like, what? You know, but, you know, you went and auditioned for the gig because it sounded like a fun gig.
It's
you
cartoons,
know? Yeah, sure. And even the money, even then, it was just like, okay, this isn't like commercial money. Like you would get for a radio commercial or a TV commercial, but it's also like much better than the hourly wage that we would get working for a temp agency or for working moving furniture as I did for a number of years. I mean, it really was kind of this bridge job that enabled a lot of us to actually continue to be actors. And most of us that started out doing ADV, doing anime stuff, we continued to do stage. We continued to do that. Suddenly, we were able to like make a living as an actor, proving all of our parents wrong. Kind of a remarkable moment for a lot of actors. Yeah. But yeah, so that's how that kind of got started.
And that's cool. It does show the evolution of the production of it, because instead of it just being an afterthought where they say, hey, this guy's going to do a voice an hour, we're done. It's like, hey, let's get people that know how to properly emote and convey with just the power of their voice.
Well, even then, it's like when the companies are starting, they would do that subtitle. You know, they were that was their first thing. It was like just like bring it over, do a good subtitle. And even then, you know, before ADV sort of kind of got the idea, like, let's use these really good actors, it was still kind of an afterthought to do a dub. It was like, well, we could do a dub, you know. And the thing is, originally, you got to remember, there was no streaming. In those days, it really wasn't even any pirated streaming because our bandwidth wasn't that great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, all the revenue was coming from VHS.
Right.
And when you got a VHS, you had to choose. And maybe this is where the debate comes from.
Actually.
You had to choose either the subtitled version or the dubbed version. You didn't get both.
Yeah.
And so,
and because you're importing them both, you can only probably have the money for one at, you know, on nerd budget. So.
You're not gonna you're not gonna necessarily buy the subtitle and buy the separate. And think about VHS, man. That's like a book. Like that takes up space on your shelf, right? So I think the lines were drawn very early. But what I think has happened is that as shows like Bubblegum Crisis kind of came on, and that was one of the first shows I think where people really started to notice, hey, that dub sounds really good. Like these are actors that are committed. And you had folks that started to build up a following, not only actors, but shows. And I think just having it available in English language, you're not having to sit there and read subtitles, but you're actually able to experience the anime as the creators intended.
For sure.
Right.
So I think it just contributed to the experience. And while that was happening, we had the advent of anime conventions. And a lot of those actors started going around, you know, promoting the work and as well as themselves and meeting the fans. I think we've all had a part to play in kind of where anime is now.
I got you.
And but as far as the debate goes, I just think I don't know that anybody really debates. Maybe they do it online or on Twitter or something. But I it's a dumb debate to have. Look, if you want to read your anime, fine. I mean, you know what I mean? I wonder if those same folks get the Japanese language version of the manga. I'm just asking. Are you a purist?
Right. Exactly. How far does the purity go?
You're still reading in English if you're reading the subtitles. I suppose you're hearing the Japanese performances, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But for me, this is very different. If we're talking live action,
yeah,
I'm not listening to the subs. That's just me. I'm not listening to the dubs.
It's live action.
I want to hear the performances that are actually
happening. Of the actor, yeah.
Although I have done live action dubs, and I commit 100%. You know, I think they're a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And
that's the difference, too, is that you are voice actors.
Right.
So you're looking for an actor. And the thing that I saw accidentally, because I did originally see it. I originally saw the original Bubblegum Crisis subtitled, and it was exactly a guy you were talking about. It wasn't my collection. I knew a guy who had a huge anime collection that he ordered out of catalogs from Japan. Some of the stuff wasn't even subtitled or dubbed. He was actively trying to learn Japanese so he could figure out his favorite things. He would take them, the VHS, they were in a sleeve. He cut the sleeves out and put them into a plastic case.
Wow.
So it would protect them better. This is the commitment level it took in 1992 when I was
and he
gave me this Bubblegum Crisis. So I know I saw it subtitled, and when I went back and looked at it, I found it online. I'm like, oh, here's a dub version. Here's my mistake. I assume the dub version was by someone like you, Funimation or ADB or one of these great companies. But no, like you had said wonderfully, it was Phil in Accounting, and it changed this wonderful show so much. Because they didn't hire a voice actor. They just hired some guy who they thought could do it.
Right.
And it comes through. And even Mikey was saying, because Mikey did the right thing. He started rewatching it, or for the first time watching it, with the subtitles.
Yep.
But I told him, dude, you have to go watch one of these dubs to see. And he said that the Foley was even off.
Oh, sure.
So
sure. It was very cheaply done. And I actually knew someone that back in the day used to do, they would go to Singapore or something. I have no idea why, maybe for South Asian dub. That doesn't even make sense because they do those in L.A. But this was a girl who had been hired at one point to do some like really fast anime dubs. And I'm talking like, they would just play the scene, and the actors would get like one pass, and that's it.
Oh,
it didn't matter if the lips, the flaps matched at all. You know, they were just looking to like lay those tracks in, and they didn't care. And it felt like they didn't care, but they would knock out. They would hire those actors to spend an entire day in the studio. I'm talking like a 9 to 5.
Yeah, just taxing them.
Just cranking out, just but one right after the other. And again, that's why you have that early mix of anime that just has an atrocious English dub, and it makes you think that's terrible. They should never dub anime at all. But like, actually, if you're watching a show that's really lovingly done and with the kind of tedious detail that our studios go through now, that's a completely different product.
Oh, for sure.
It's not even it's fish and bicycles, apples and oranges. Yeah, I mean, it's not the same.
So I think we've settled the debate. If as long as it's after a certain time in the 90s,
yeah.
You're fine.
I think somewhere around 97, 98 is probably like the tipping point where that started really changing.
So can we talk a little bit about where you started, where this all came from, your acting before?
Well, you know, I was inclined toward it. I think I spent most of my high school years just kind of drifting around. I did athletics. I played football at Texas High School. And
okay.
I was into basketball and it wasn't really, I didn't love it. I'm kind of a big guy, so I think I was naturally just kind of pulled into those things because they thought, you know, you should play sports. But what I really wanted to do was act. And when I was a freshman in high school, I started getting involved in my high school's theater program.
Nice.
And by the time I was a senior, I was kind of looped back into it after having not done it for a couple of years. And at a certain point, I decided I wanted to try to go to school for it. Much to, again, my parents' confusion. And,
you're talking to two art school kids over here, so we get it.
You get it.
You were bitten by that bug.
Sure. Yeah. I really was. I really was. And my high school had a really terrific theater program, and so I was surrounded by the kids who I felt like really knew what they were doing, and I just was huge fans. They were gifted. In fact, one of my classmates was went on to do an obscure show that you might have heard of, Big Bang.
Big Bang Theory?
The Big Bang Hypothesis.
Sounds kind of
familiar. Big Bang Theory. Yeah, Jim Parsons was in my class.
Oh, really?
He went to,
how about that?
He and I both also went to the University of Houston. And
there you go.
So there was just like, there were a lot of really talented people in my high school that I admired, that I kind of aspired to be, you know, to do that level of work. And then when I got into college, of course, it was all that much more competitive. But
Yeah. Sounds like you came up with it. You had a cool group around you. This
I did, and I just wanted to do theater. I had no sense of even. I loved movies, but I had no sense that that was a practical pursuit.
Okay,
and certainly, anime, even voice acting wasn't really on my radar screen. I just really wanted to be a stage actor, and then I kind of, you know, mentioned to you just previously that, you know, while we were, I guess I would say in my early mid 20s, just kicking around doing theater and moving from job to job when ADV kind of happened. And I was sort of recruited. There's two guys I always give credit for. One is Lou Temple, who is an old friend of mine.
And nice.
He's probably best known these days for having played, having been on The Walking Dead in season, I don't know if it was two or three. He played Axel.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then he went on to play roles for Rob Zombie. He was in Devil's Rejects.
Oh, Devil's Rejects.
Yeah,
okay.
He was Axel, or he was Banjo and Sullivan. He was Adam Banjo.
Yeah.
Same guy. And then another friend named Gil, actually Brian Lundy, who I always say is the best voice actor who you've never heard of, because he disappeared. And he was an early voice talent with ADV Films. And I just thought he was tremendous.
Okay.
And just life situation took him and his wife and family elsewhere. And he did not continue acting. He didn't continue voicing. But he was one of the guys with ADV that kind of recruited me in. So that's how I got started. It just kind of
ADV is a local
there.
Texas company. And
I was in Houston at the time. Yeah. Yeah. So that's where it got started.
So do you have any insight on how Texas became this hub of, because, I mean, Funimation, ADV, all this, it's so interesting to me.
It's interesting. I would be interested to know if there was, and I don't think there is, any connection at all in terms of the origin stories of Funimation and an ADV, unless one of them saw what the other was doing and said, hey, I can do that too.
Yeah.
It's Jen Fukunaga, who is the founder and original owner of Funimation.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was, I don't know if he was a Dragon Ball fan and decided that he was going to fund bringing that over. And it was, you know, the early story of Funimation is completely intertwined with Dragon Ball.
Yeah.
Those two stories are inseparable. Mm-hmm. It's a little different with ADV, which was, you know, started by Matt Greenfield and John Ledford back in the mid-90s.
Okay.
And again, just a couple fanboys. I think they worked together at a video store or something, or an electronics store. And Matt was just like, Matt was like the brains of the outfit, I guess. And I don't know. I don't know how to divide what those guys. All I know is that Matt was the boots on the ground. He was the director and the guy that knew all about anime. John was always the guy that wore the suit. Right. And walk down the hall. And I figured he would go to his office and like crunch numbers or something. I don't know.
John the businessman.
Yeah, sure. But yeah, those were the guys that would like license. They would buy these licenses back when they were cheap, because Japan had no sense that there was a market in the United States, because there wasn't.
It was
a chance for them to make a few more bucks by selling this license to these Yahoos down in Houston. Yeah, do with it what you want. Like, you know, if you can figure out how to make us a few more cents, fine.
Yeah.
And so they did. They went and bought these things. And I've heard the stories that they've told. They probably tell it better. But they would localize the scripts. They would come up with artwork for the, you know, for their North American distribution or whatever distribution they had. But even their early stuff, I think, was done on tape. They used to talk about putting all these digital tapes in their car and like driving to Dallas because they didn't have a studio in Houston that could handle doing what they needed, which was tracking the audio to the video.
Yeah.
And it sounded incredibly labor intensive, but it was a labor of love for those guys.
It was their passion.
They saw something though.
Yeah.
It was their passion and a hobby, but they saw some potential there. And I think those guys are what seeded. I'm convinced of this, that the work that those guys were putting out as ADV Films early on, and AD Vision, that was their original name of their company, I think really seeded the fan base, because those titles, they made their way into like Blockbuster. Like there was a time when we had video stores, most notably Blockbuster, and you would walk in and there would be like a kids section, a cartoon section.
Yeah.
And the first anime titles were in those sections.
Because it was all animation.
Yeah, but what happened was, as it began to grow in popularity, they actually carved out their own space. So you would go in there and you would see anime.
Yes.
And so if you were a kid in the, you know, I don't know, mid-late 90s, you could go, like, that's where you got your fix, is you would go rent those titles from, you know, and then, of course, you'd buy from ADV. They had their catalog, you know, where you could actually buy titles. So I think it's interesting that at the same time, ADV was kind of becoming known for their plethora of licenses and titles, that Dragon Ball was becoming a thing as well. And the idea that, oh, Funimation, well, that was just a name that you put on it. That, you know, you had to have a name. Well, as it turns out, that's what fueled what Funimation now is, is their kind of clout and their affiliation with Dragon Ball and Toei. And
is so, Dragon Ball the property you get recognized most from, would you say?
Yeah, it depends on what kind of show I'm at. I mean, I think a lot of fans recognize me from The Walking Dead, you know, because of the four seasons I was on there. Yep. And there is a small subsection of people that are crossover that know both things. But for sure, Dragon Ball, I mean, it's just been an incredible ride for me. I mean, having done this for all these years, and then in just, I don't know, what was Battle of Gods, what, 5 years ago? I don't know. To suddenly get cast in a role that has that kind of just really worldwide phenomenon attached to it.
And Super and Dragon Ball Super, the one we're talking about, seems to be leveling up the game. I mean, sure. If you love Dragon Ball that we're talking about that ADV brought over, it's they're just
or the Funimation brought over. Yeah, no, it's interesting meeting fans, and every once in a while I'll meet someone that is a fan or is familiar with work that I did from the ADV days.
There you go.
And they want me to sign a DVD cover that I haven't seen in ages, if ever. I signed one here last night. It was a cover for a show called Hugo the Negotiator.
Of course.
Which was a really obscure ADV title. I was very proud of it because it was kind of an interesting, very dramatic, you know, it wasn't swords and sandals and magic and fairies and all that stuff. It was just very straight, serious subject matter. This guy was basically a hostage negotiator. He gets flown around the world to, like, into the harshest places that you can imagine. And but you know, nobody watched it. It wasn't like really fan friendly. You had to be really interested in like international politics to be into this anime, right?
You got to enjoy that cup of tea.
Sure. Like Detective Leon from Bubblegum Crisis excited me because he's like the cop's cop, the ultimate cop. Super cop.
Always wears the sunglasses.
Always wears the sunglasses. He's shaped like an upside down triangle.
Yeah. Precisely.
That character just delights me in how cop he is.
Right. That was maybe the second or third anime that I was cast in. It was also the first show of an actor named Chris Patton, who I go way back with.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's in L.A. now, but he was quite active with ADV back in those early days. He was quite good. It was also the first show for a fantastic actress named Hillary Haig, who was another big name. It's interesting the way certain people have shuffled around and names have come and gone. But that was...
That was one of the interesting parts to hear about in your panel is that it does seem to be there's a real large community to the anime voiceover and voiceover actor arena because you're talking with people like you worked with different people over different projects, but they seem to be names that frequently repeat.
Well, there is a large, it seems like a pretty large group now.
Yeah.
It wasn't the case then. I mean, there were probably 20 or 30 of us that did all the roles.
So it was a tiny group. You guys were doing like multitasking, I guess.
Yeah, in some cases, but we were busy, and it felt like a company. You know, it felt like a company of actors, and that was okay. Yeah. You know what I mean? And that was fine. And of course, the ADV and as Funimation, I'm sure they wanted to expand their talent base and would regularly hold auditions. But now it's crazy because there's a lot of younger people that are in it now. That's the reason we had that panel last night, just to kind of try to attempt to have a conversation about what does this actually look like? Because even though it seems like just yesterday that I started doing this, it's actually been nearly a quarter of a century. And there's people that have been doing it for just 5 years or 10 years. Mm-hmm. And they started doing it because they wanted to do it because they grew up watching a lot of the stuff that we did.
There you go.
And that's a big difference, I think, between now and 20 years ago. Nobody was going to acting school. Nobody was taking classes so that they could go do anime.
Oh,
that just
sure.
didn't happen.
Yeah.
It did not happen. Yeah. And it's astonishing to me today that it does happen, even now.
That's a credit to you and all the good work that you and your compatriots at the time did.
Yeah.
Because it made it successful, so.
I guess we're working ourselves out of a job. Now we have to compete with these young whippersnappers.
That's terrific. So we don't want to take up too much more of your time.
No, it's good. It's been fun.
Thanks for talking to us.
Sure.
Where can people find you? Is there another convention you're going to be headed to next that they can get you and on the social medias and all that stuff?
Yeah, I'm a little behind on booking shows for 2020. The only thing I have coming up as of this broadcast is a show in New Zealand.
Whoa!
So it's it's the
how awesome is that
anime?
Wow.
It's like it's like Armageddon Expo or something.
Wow!
And I don't know.
Sounds like a perfect place for it.
Wellington or Auckland or something. I'll have to look that up. But that's my next public appearance. And
has your work taken you to Australia before?
No,
with video games or anything. Okay,
I've had offers to go down there, but I just haven't been able to work it out.
That's exciting.
So I'm excited to go down. You know, I'm still doing. Obviously, I'm still pursuing on camera work. I've got some films coming out. There's a really cool science fiction film called Dropa. I play this with interestingly enough, the co-lead of this film is David Matranga, who's also a well-known voice actor. So,
yeah.
So that'll be fun. And then, yeah, there's some other stuff. I just shot a film called Whitetail.
Is it about a deer?
It does have deer in it.
Oh, nice.
But it's kind of a
shot horror. In the dark. Could have been a rabbit.
It's kind of a horror thriller, kind of a Texas gothic horror thriller. It's a guy and his son. And his uncle, they are the three of them. They go hunting, and what they kind of stumble into is the aftermath of like this robbery, these sadistic robbers, and they're out there, and there's just this interaction, and so that's kind of fun.
I'm intrigued. That sounds right up my alley.
Yeah, I'm off to Baltimore next week to work on a film called Cyst with a filmmaker that I recently worked with. I just did the voice for the troll in Under Control, which is this German sort of pseudo sequel to the Troll 2.
Like
film.
The Troll 2 movie? Like
Troll 2,
unanimously the worst movie ever.
Absolutely,
made.
Yeah. George Hardy is in this film.
No way.
No kidding. Yeah,
that's
great. So he's
you're gonna play a troll in Under Control.
Under Control. I'm the voice of the lead troll. Here, get this. You want to talk about dub. This is what they did.
Bring it on.
This is like so this German filmmaking company, they decided to make this very kind of low budget sequel to Troll 2.
Nice.
Okay. They shot it. So they're in Germany, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they use all German actors, but they decided to write an English script and perform it in English. Okay, so the performers are speaking English, but they're German, so they don't speak very good English.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a second language. Mm-hmm.
And then what they decided was that they needed to go back in and dub over all of their German lines, or their English, all of the lines, back into German. So this is the German version of the film. It's German dubbed over English by German actors.
Mm-hmm.
And now what they've done is they brought the film to the United States. They've freshened up the audio tracks, and they hired some of us, guys like me and Brett Weaver and Chris Sabat, to redub the script back into English. And they also rewrote the script in, you know, it's a very Troll 2 approach to filmmaking.
I was almost worried that you were going to tell me that they had you set up to, you have to learn German so you could deliver these lines in German and then dub over the German with your English.
It almost felt that crazy, but but anyway, it's out there. So Under Control, it's a silly, campy, but you know, nobody's going to get their feelings hurt by me saying that because I think it's very intentionally... This is
be,
a movie that, like, you would probably go to a midnight showing and throw popcorn at the screen.
And like an MST3K type thing. Yeah, that's kind of funny because they used to do that with a lot of the movies that you see on MST3K. They would have, like, Italian actors doing English lines, and they'd redub over them because their English was so bad.
Yep.
That's funny. All right, where can they, is there anywhere they can find you on social media or online?
Yeah, please, the easiest one is to remember, probably, is Twitter, Mr. Jason Douglas.
Mr. Jason Douglas.
Yeah. And I'm also on Instagram and Facebook, so just look for Jason Douglas, you know, search for me on those platforms, I'm there. But I'm mostly on Twitter. I don't know why. It's such a toxic place.
It is.
It's quick and easy, though.
But I don't participate in the toxicity.
Yeah,
I'm just there to kind of like read the news and see what other people are saying about stuff.
Yeah.
And occasionally I, you know, post something goofy.
Goofy is our bread and butter, sure.
Right on.
Well, thanks for talking to us, Jason. We really appreciate it. We want to thank everyone for listening to our podcast. We want to thank Anime Dallas 2019 for having us out here.
Very much so.
We want to thank that guy, Brad, for doing our announcing and walking around handing stickers out and stuff. We want to thank Not Scott Productions for our equipment and Jazzar for doing our music. The Local Game Store in Richardson, Texas for being our local game store at The Best LGS on Facebook. You can find us on social medias at Assuming Pod. Gmail us, assumingpositions@gmail.com. Get out there, watch some expertly dubbed anime by the likes of Jason Douglas.
Please.
See you all.
See ya.
Thank you, Jason.
Good show, guys.
Fun. Thanks,